Afternoon. We have been talking about conciliar movement and theory last week. I'd like to continue that this afternoon. We took up the council that met at Pisa, and then the council as it met at Constance, where, as you possibly recall from your reading at least, the new voting method was adopted, which did not allow the Italian representatives to control the council as much as had been true previously at Pisa. And then they also issued this declaration called the Frequence, which indicated that a council should be called frequently at intervals, regular intervals, and should become then the final authority in the church, to which even the Bishop of Rome would be subject. The next council then meets at Basel from 1432. It moves from Basel to Ferrara, and then finally to Florence, again at intervals, Basel, Ferrara, Florence, finally disbanded in 1449. This council, as we indicated last time, had been called legitimately by the Roman bishop, but once it was called, he attempted to dissolve it. Eugenius was the pope's name. That's not so important. The point, however, is that this council refused to be dissolved and then proceeded with an attempt to limit the authority of the pope, especially in certain areas. Two specifically, those of taxation and those of control, and that of controlling the appointment of the clergy in various areas. However, the prelates meeting at Basel were not able to agree on precisely how they wanted the authority of the Roman bishop to be limited, to limit papal taxation, or the ability of the papacy to tax, was a difficult thing because this money was needed by the bureaucracy to administrate the Roman Catholic Church throughout Western Europe, the same kind of difficulty that the Renaissance popes will face in the 15th and then in the early 16th century, when you do have Roman bishops who want to carry out the kind of financial reforms, for example, that Luther and many others were encouraging, but found it impossible because the money that was collected via these processes was absolutely necessary if the church was to continue to operate as it had been operating. There was no other way to do it. A great deal of this financial apparatus had been set up first in the 14th century at Avignon. It's one of the great contributions of the French papacy. When you read, for example, in Luther's Babylonian Captivity about this, I think it's very important to realize that much of what he talks about there is rather more recent than ancient in the history of the Roman Church. When the Italian papacy is cut off from the financial resources of Italy, having moved to France, it is necessary to find other ways of raising money. And many of these things that Luther talks about then come from this 14th century period first, when the papacy was at Avignon. Well, in any case, those who met at Basel attempted to carry out this reform, but they were really not able to, because they themselves couldn't agree as to precisely how much money was needed for administrating the Roman Church, and if needed, how it was to be collected. Similarly, in the matter of clerical appointments, Rome had evidenced a deep concern for the education of the clergy, for the clergy centering their attention on spiritual tasks, on the concerns of the church as such. And of course, there were those who were fearful that if you curtail the authority now of Rome to control, to appoint, to dispose of clergymen, you would perhaps also be curtailing, if not eliminating, these efforts at reform in this area, in the church, in these years. And so there was no agreement. And Basil then just fizzles out, as it were. They say many things negatively about the papacy. Much is said. One of the most important things that happens, of course, in this context, is that it is precisely in these years that the donation of Constantine is discredited. And many of the conciliarists latch on to this also as a as an indication of the fact that councils really are superior to the Roman bishop. The two individuals, of course, that are important there are Lorenzo Valla and Nicholas of Cusa, or Nicholas Cusanus. So ultimately what happens is that out of this conciliar movement in the first half of the 15th century, you ultimately have a papal victory. Because the conciliarists, those who were present at the council, and also the conciliar theorists, could not agree, it's almost as if the papacy had given the conciliarists enough rope so that they hung themselves or hanged themselves. This wasn't purposely done on the part of the Roman bishop. They had no other choice. But if they had done it purposely, they couldn't have approached it more masterfully, actually, because these conciliarists simply did go to the extreme where they could all agree that we're against, theoretically, the authority of the papacy, but beyond that, they could find no very little more than that on which they could agree, at least to write definitions and canons by which to govern the church. If you compare, for example, the Sacra Sancta, as it was promulgated at Constance, to which all could agree at Constance, or at least the majority could agree, in 1415, which was a carrying forward of the theory, the conciliar theory that you have already in the frequence, asserting council above papacy, not apart from papacy, but at least above papacy or above pope. Compare that with the papal decree of 1460, and you can read both of these in Bettinson. I think you can see the contrast between them, and it is the second, ex crabilis, rather than the sacra sancta, that ultimately obtains in the medieval Catholic Church. It obtains for two reasons, primarily, that both the Eastern Orthodox and the national churches, the local churches, found it impossible to deal with the conciliarists meeting at Basel, and consequently turned once again to make their deals with the Bishop of Rome. In other words, it was simply impossible to work with this thing called a council at Basel. It was not able to govern the church because they couldn't agree on what they wanted for the church, that is, for the government of the church. And so those who found it necessary, for one reason or another, to to deal. That is, those who were interested in order in the church dealt with the Roman bishop. You know the story of the bishops of the Eastern Orthodox Church from Constantinople coming to Florence in the 40s of the 15th century. If you don't, please read it in your text. We've already discussed this in connection with efforts to heal the Great Schism of 1054. However, the important point here is that the Eastern bishops coming to the West do not go to Basel to deal with the council, because there was no authority on which anyone could rely there. So they turn to the Roman bishop. And similarly, the national clergy in England, for example, in France and in Spain, the kings of these areas and the archbishops, the representatives of the clergy, in appointing clergy especially, and also in the area of ecclesiastical taxation, find it impossible to deal with this government by council, and much more, it was simply a matter of utility, I suppose, to deal with the Bishop of Rome. And so the French church, for example, in 1438, works out the pragmatic sanction with the authority of the Bishop of Rome in mind, not with the authority of a council. The Gallican, this is the beginning of what we call the Gallican Church. The Gallican Articles, as we'll find them, in the 18th century, this continues all the way through now, where the Gallican Church, the French Church, asserts that it has certain special rights within the Roman Catholic Church. This is very important. Similarly, the various duchies and in Germany, the various areas in Germany, draw up agreements with the Roman Pope rather than with the conciliars. Ferdinand and Isabella in Spain do the same thing. So that each one of these, what shall we call them, dynastic areas, they are not really nationalistic areas, in the later sense of the term at least, but dynastic areas, make a political agreement, a treaty, with the Roman bishop rather than with the conciliar. These treaties are called concordats, the kind of thing that the Roman Church continues to make with various groups today. One of the most important things, I suppose, on the docket of the Pope in Rome today is to work out such a concordat with the Soviets in Russia today, just as they have worked out such concordats with men like Hitler and Mussolini and the various areas of the church in Europe in the past. So they would attempt to strike up a treaty. What rights do the clergy have? How are they to be taxed? And all of this sort of thing now in Russia. Well, it's that these concordats were drawn up with the Roman bishop rather than with the conciliaries that are so important and that ultimately give the victory to the Roman bishop rather than to the conciliaries. Now, after this, after the pontificate of Eugene, who, if you will check with your papal list, was the pope during this one council or three councils at Basel, Ferrara, Florence, the papacy moves into the period of what we know as the Renaissance. There's very little more to say, actually. Nicholas V founds the Vatican Library, plans for a new and bigger St. Peter's. Pius II, the famous Pope Piccolomini, a very learned and able, a Renaissance Pope in the highest sense of the term. Sixtus IV built the Sistine Chapel, then you get the Medici popes and the Borgia popes, the names that are all associated with the Renaissance papacy. So once the conciliar movement is defeated, and power returns to the hands of the papacy as well as the wealth that is involved, you have this great mushrooming of cultural effort that we know as the Renaissance papacy. But you still have the theory, and that's very important, because conciliar theory coming into its own in the 15th century continues to dominate, and to play its role in the thinking of the church after that. People will appeal to council. Popes will condemn any kind of appealing to council as automatic heresy. This all becomes very important after this period, even though it was a failure in the 15th century. It took nothing away from the Roman bishop, but it served to emphasize the kind of authority that he actually did have in the church of that day. Now, I put ancient here with a question mark behind it because, as I indicated last time, there is some question of whether you have conciliar theory in the ancient church or whether you have only council, and whether perhaps what was being appealed to by these conciliarists in the 15th century as ancient theory was nothing of the kind. You can study that on your own if you would like. The point that I would like to make here, however, is to develop the thinking of these men, D'Ailly and Gerson, the two French theorists, in the propositions of the one and the unity of the church in the other, and then also to move along from this into the thinking of men like Wycliffe and Huss, whose thinking is rather closely related to the theology of the church that you have in conciliar theory. First of all, then, D'Ailly and Gerson, Jean Gerson. You remember Gerson was the keynote speaker at Constance. He had studied under D'Ailly. Both of these men are products of the University of Paris. Paris was the faculty, the theological faculty in Europe at this time. The French of this period of the Middle Ages, and indeed all through the next centuries, will be proud of their university, and especially of the theological faculty at Paris, the Sorbonne. There is a very fine article, if you're interested, on the conciliar theory of Pierre D'Ailly in the Church History Journal from December 1960. I would encourage you to read it because I think it gives you a very fine insight into the thinking of these conciliarists. Basically, for D'Ailly, the church was made up of the aggregate of the faithful. There is where ultimate authority resided in the church. You know, all of the faithful. Not in bishops, much less in pope, but in all of the faithful. The theory was that all of the faithful then are represented in council, which is only a theory, of course, and no more than this, because there was no political machinery by which all of the faithful allowed a council to speak for them. The papacy, then, according to D'Ailly, was nothing more than an administrative officer, so to speak, the executor of the legislators, that is, the councils, who represented the people, and consequently were subordinate. But dial, and what Gerson says in his On the Unity of the Church is not too much different from this. These two men never think of the church as, or of councils as attempting to operate apart from the traditions and the authority, albeit subordinate authority, of the papacy. Let me read to you from this article a number of theses from Dial. These all of these all occur also in the in Jean Gerson. He says, according to that saying, Christ is the head of the church, and that other one, we are all one body in Christ. The unity of the mystical body of the whole Christian church depends fully and perfectly upon the unity of Christ, his head. Rather similar to the kind of thing that Luther will say later on. Secondly, although the Pope, inasmuch as he is the vicar of Christ, can in a certain way be said to be the head of the church, nevertheless, the unity of the church does not necessarily depend upon, nor originate from, the unity of the Pope. Now, this is very important for the kind of conciliar theory that you have with Dial and with Gerson. This is clear, Dial says, from the first dictum, and also because of the fact that the church remains one, even when there is no pope, in accordance with that saying of the canticles, my dove is one, and that of the symbol, I believe one holy Catholic and apostolic church. So even if you have schism, and of course, Dial and Gerson wrote their material very early in the 15th century as a response to the problem of schism, rather than, say, after the Council of Basel. I think they probably would have written it differently, at least the antitheses in it would have been different if they had written it later. So that's the one kind of conciliar theory that you have. This is highly theoretical, based actually on civil law, on the new civil law, theories of civil law that come from a new study now of the Theodosian and Justinian legal tradition from the 6th century A.D. That is, that ultimate sovereignty lies with the people. The people delegate this sovereignty once and for all. It can never, it's not retained by the people then, but they delegate it. Most of these individuals agreed to the civil canonists that this sovereignty is delegated to the civic leader, that is to prince or king. And the church serves only in one area of the Christian society, that is the area of the spiritual, is definitely subordinate to the civil ruler, and within the church itself, council is superior to papacy. I've already mentioned Marsilio of Padua's Defensor Pacis last time when we talked about Louis the Bavarian, where you have a very similar thesis enunciated, also stemming from a renewed study of the tradition of civil law rather than of canon law. Now, you have a similar kind of theory coming from also from the study of canon law. I don't want to go into that, but taking the Decretum of Gratian and the various revisions of it that had come since the 12th century, these conciliarists, as I've already indicated, went back into the canons of the early church to find resource for their theory of a church governed by council. So it's a very interesting study to take up, to see how they found this in the canon. One of the most important passages, of course, on which these conciliar canonists debated was Matthew 16, Thou art Peter. and the various ways that they attempted to reconcile the various interpretations of this passage in the tradition. By this time, of course, in medieval Christianity, tradition is very clearly distinct from Scripture. As you know, I hope by this time from your reading, minimal though it is in Irenaeus or in Tertullian, this was not the case in their writings. By this time it is, and tradition is that authority by which Scripture is used, so to speak, in the church. But now, when you have in the tradition itself, in the body of Christian teachers, and usually the great theologians were studied on the basis of compendia of their statements. Well, you had all kinds of statements, varying statements, as to what this "Thou art Peter, and on this rock I will build my church" actually stood for. Some of them had said that it referred to Christ, that Christ was building the church on himself. That's what he referred to when he says, "You are rock, Peter, you are me." Some said, no, this is the Pope he's referring to, Peter as an individual. Others said that it was Peter's faith and so forth. Well, these canonists attempted to work some kind of harmony out of all of these divergent opinions. And then, in the case of conciliar theorists, attempted to work out a conciliar theory. The way they did this, of course, was to compare what our Lord says in Matthew about Peter to what he says in John about all of the disciples, not giving them the keys so much, but giving them the power to bind and to loose. Well, you put these together, and by manipulating your quotations, you are able to come out with some kind of a conciliar theory announced already from the mouth of our Lord, that the church is to be governed by a group, and that's what they did. Now, two individuals that have little to do with the councils themselves, except that one was burned at Constance, John Huss, they have little to do with the actual goings-on of the councils, still are very, very much a part of this conciliar tradition, and both of them grow up or grow out of the same tradition that Dai and Gerson come out of. There can hardly be a question about that. They have the same roots, except that where Dai and Gerson do not find themselves condemned as heretics because they perhaps are not as radical, although when you're radical, you're radical. Both of them are radical. It's just that Wycliffe and Huss were more radical. And both of them, however, are ultimately condemned. Wycliffe is condemned at Constance also. He couldn't be burned because he had died decades previously. But Huss and his closest associate, Jerome of Prague, could be and were. The material in Bettinson on Wycliffe, yes, you have the pages there. There isn't really anything other than that to say about John Huss, because Huss learned everything he knew about this question from the same tradition that Wycliffe learned what he knew, and in many cases, Huss is related directly to Wycliffe himself, so that you could call Huss a Wycliffeite. It's one of the curiosities about Luther's attitude. Luther was very sympathetic to John Huss. He says many very favorable things about him, but he is most unfavorable to John Wycliffe. And this is rather curious, because they stand for the same thing. It seems that Luther is evidently referring, in the case of Huss, to his ecclesiastical theory, and in the case of Wycliffe, to his civil theory or his social theory. But both of them really stood for the same thing. It's just that evidently Luther wasn't very familiar. Well, Luther wasn't familiar with either of them when he began his efforts. There's a very good article on this, I think, in the Concordia Theological Monthly from 1949 by Yaroslav Pelikan. It is a condensation of his doctoral dissertation, Luther's Negotiations with the Hussites, from volume 20, 1949, in the CTM. If you're interested in the relationship between Luther and Huss, I think you will find this to be very interesting. Well, I'd like to take a look at these two men in this context, then. I assume that on the basis of your reading, you will be able to get all of the background about these two Johns, Wycliffe and Huss, that you will want. We won't go into all of that. You can get it out of the book. But I do want to talk about the ecclesiastical theory, because I think that's very important for our purposes here. Wycliffe, of course, in his work on the church, written already in 1378. In other words, this is Wycliffe, and Wycliffe's writings precede those of Guy and Gerson. We take them in this way because he along with Huss, is branded as a heretic. We sort of put them in a separate category because of their relationship to Luther and to the whole Reformation movement in the church. However, as I indicated, there is very little difference, really. In his On the Church, Wycliffe is obviously combating the authority of the church hierarchy. He is doing this in the beginning in support of parliamentary authority in the English church. Wycliffe, of course, was a student and then a teacher and spent all of his life at the University of Oxford. When he writes, he is suggesting in the first place that ultimate authority in the church does not lie in the hierarchy. And by that he means primarily the archbishop and more specifically the curia in Italy, and then the papacy itself, or the pope himself. But rather, in England, it resides in Parliament. This is the era of the good Parliament in England, of course. And he too, this theory comes out of what I've mentioned in connection with Gerson, the idea that the ultimate sovereignty lies with the people. They turn it over to their representatives. In England, it's the Parliament. And the Parliament, then, is to govern the church. His whole theory of property is involved in this also, because here Wycliffe, taking his material, at least in part, from St. Thomas Aquinas, believed that all property is God's. He would have very little use for any theory of private property and the inviolability of property and that kind of thing that I suppose you would have to call Wycliffe very much of a communist, really, with a small c, in his property theory, his theory of property, because property for him always is God's, and people are only given the privilege of using it, and that toward and for holy purposes. And when they don't use it for that, then they have no right to possess it. In other words, there is no such thing as inviolable private property. You don't have this anywhere in medieval theory. This is a modern economic theory and is not part of any earlier theories of property. In any case, it's in the context of all of this that Wycliffe is, that he says many derogatory things about the hierarchy of the church, insisting that the church is not over there where the prelates and the bishops are, but the church is where the people are. And there, of course, he's very similar to what we have already again read in dying. This leads him to an emphasis on the universal priesthood of all believers. This is not the great contribution of Martin Luther. He taught it, of course. I'm not quarreling with that. But there were those who taught it before he did in the church and emphasized it, at least in Luther's later career, far more than he did. The priesthood of all believers, that's the second point that comes through in this on the church, the De Ecclesia of Wycliffe. So combating the church as hierarchy, Wycliffe asserts that the church is all people. But then Wycliffe goes on from there and asserts something again that Luther is often credited with doing, and that's distinguishing between the visible and the invisible church. Now Luther says this. I've just been reading a recent book on Luther, on his view of church history by Headley, and again you can find many quotations in Luther, as he does, to support that Luther didn't teach or distinguish between the visible and the invisible church. But all of these things had already been said by Wycliffe and Huss, and are much more the center of their approach to the problems of the church than it is the center of Luther's approach to the problem of the church. In other words, what Wycliffe is saying is that ultimately the church is Augustine's city of God. Wycliffe was a predestinarian. God predestines those whom he wants to be part of his body, of his people. You cannot know who God has predestined. Therefore, the church is essentially invisible. He said that there are three places, three phases to the church, all of which are invisible: the church in heaven, the church in purgatory, and the church on earth. In all three cases, the outlines, the extent of the church is hidden, because it's in the face of people, and you can't see face, and it's in this way. But again, the whole argument, as it becomes with Luther later on, is that the antithesis is the church as hierarchy. Now, fourthly, finally, then, in this on the church, the papacy, again, very similar to what we have seen in Dai, is nothing more than that which, on the basis of a need to organize and to run the church peacefully, you simply allow a man like this to do it. In other words, the point that I'm trying to make is that he didn't look upon the papacy as something divinely ordained and absolutely necessary for the church. In other words, if you want to know where the church is, you don't say over there, those who are related to the papacy. Rather, the papacy, as Luther would say, is all right, as long as you recognize that it's merely a device in the human mind for the government of the church, but by sanctified minds for the government of the church. Now, another thing that I think we should note, although it does not occur in this De Ecclesia, is that Wycliffe was a promoter of the vernacular Bible. In his case, of course, in English. Not only the vernacular Bible, but tracts giving important excerpts from the Bible. Very important for those who find themselves saying today yet that there were no vernacular Bibles before Luther translated it out of the Latin. This is patent nonsense. I'll have more to say about this in connection with the mystics, but Wycliffe was also known for translating the Bible, and these preachers that he sent around, the so-called Lullards, not only preached, but also distributed Bible paraphrases, tracts, selections, and so forth from the Holy Bible in their preaching. Well, this puts Wycliffe then in the context of the conciliar theory, and that's what we were attempting to do. Now, Hus in Bohemia was a professor and chaplain at the University of Prague in Bohemia. It seems that the sister of the King of Bohemia married Richard II of England, and when this great alliance took place, consequently, dynastic alliance between England and Bohemia, many Bohemian students went to study at Oxford, and there they came into contact with Lollard ideas, and among them, out of this then comes the influence on this John Hus at Prague. Hus, however, becomes the focal point not only of this kind of a theory of the church that you have in men like Dyer and also in Wycliffe, but he is also associated, as was Wycliffe, with reform movements in Bohemia. There was quite a bit of antagonism within Bohemia between the German and the Czech elements. Hus represented both, but being a Czech, he was resented very much by the German element, and especially by the bishop, who was also German. And this is what originally got him into trouble. Then, even though he had been excommunicated, he continued to preach. From this, he alienated many of his closest friends, at least socially, if not intellectually. In any case, Sigismund, who was not unsympathetic to Hus, suggested that he come to Constance to defend himself. And there, as you know the story, he is condemned and burned at the stake. Because he and Wycliffe went much further than either Dyer or Gerson were willing to go in suggesting, and both Wycliffe and Hus suggest this, that when a Roman bishop is not morally correct, morally pure, morally the leader of Christendom, in other words, when he becomes guilty of things like simony and so forth, he is then no longer Pope, automatically. Well, this is a refurbished donatism that was condemned already in the early church, and as you know, you can't operate an ecclesiastical organization on that kind of a basis, and it's seemingly for this reason, although I've often found this very difficult. I've always found this very difficult, but it's seemingly for this reason that Gerson was willing to vote for the burning of John Hus, even though there was a great deal of agreement. In other words, Gerson would suggest that the church should be governed by council, but that the papacy remains as inviolable and as holy as ever. You see, in everything else. Wycliffe and Hus didn't think that way about the papacy. For them, as Wycliffe often says, the Pope is nothing more today than the representative of Antichrist. And Hus said the same thing. As you probably know, in the 20s of the 16th century, Luther will come to say the same thing. Even though Hus is burned at Constance, the movement continues in Bohemia after 1416, and ultimately two groups develop out of the Hussite movement. The Lollard movement, of course, continues in England today too under a different name. They're called we call them Methodists. Dr. Sauer preached a sermon on them in chapel here a while back. Anybody remember the... What was that? Dissenters, yes. They become part of the movement known as the dissent movement in England later on. In Bohemia, however, there is you have two groups, the less radical, the conservative group, the so-called Utraquists, U-T-R-A-Q-U-I-S-T-S. You'll study this in religious bodies, but I think it's important to see that here is where this particular group originates. This is a group that today is one of the groups within the Roman Catholic Church, where priests are allowed to marry, for example, and where communion is celebrated under both kinds. In other words, that's what the word utraque, sub utraque, specie, means, under two species, if you can follow my Latin. Secondly, the second group that develops out of this is the more radical, the Unitas Fratrum, the brotherhood, the followers of John Huss, who are outside of the Hussite Church. This group continues in Czechoslovakia today. We had a representative of this group on our campus last year and had a very interesting conversation with him about the life of this church in Czechoslovakia under the Soviet authority. Okay, I think we'll stop there with the conciliar movement, and I think we'll stop there for today. Tomorrow, then, we will take up mysticism and move on then to, we'll take up mysticism in the first place. Be sure to turn in your papers